This week we've had our minds focused on the world tomorrow, a vastly different world than the one we live in right now. We live at the end of Satan's works. Satan's works, and what's it achieved? He's got mankind to the stage where mankind can wipe himself off the face of the earth. Isn't that really clever? That took 6,000 years. When I started preparing this sermon, I aimed at going through the book of Ecclesiastes and showing how it ties in with tabernacles, because the Jews particularly read the book of Ecclesiastes at this time of the year. But I got more and more discouraged reading all the Jewish commentaries, because as one man summed it up, he said, life sucks and then you die. And that was the way that, you know, the end result of most of these great men. So I thought, well, let's have a look at Solomon. And it got to be very, very interesting, because I'd never really examined the book in detail. And when you examine the book in detail, a lot of things come to light that you don't notice first off. First of all, you've got to ask the question, was he just a little bit off track right from the very beginning, before God actually spoke to him? If you turn to 1 Kings 3, 1 Kings 3, verse 1, and we can have a look at this. Solomon made affinity with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her into the city of David until he had made an end of building his own house and the house of the Eternal and the wall of Jerusalem all about. Now, one of the Bible commentaries makes a note saying, God had strictly forbidden his people to form alliances with heathenish women, lest they should lead their hearts away from him into idolatry, which of course is exactly what happened to Solomon. Let us hear the law, neither shall you make marriages with them, your daughters shall not give unto his son, nor his daughters shall thou take to your son, for they will turn away your son from following me. And they quote Exodus 34, verse 16, Deuteronomy 7, verse 3, and Deuteronomy 7, verse 4. So, you know, even people in the world can see that this was straight away a major problem. Now, if you read in 1 Kings 3, verse 2, only the people sacrificed in high places, because there was no house built under the name of the Lord until those days. So this is like a pagan practice. And Solomon loved the Eternal, walking in the statutes of David his father, only he sacrificed and burnt incense in the high places. Sounds a bit like the church today in many cases. You know, we keep the commandments of God, but we change this point, or we change that point. Just not a complete, total commitment. Then we get to verse 5. And this is extremely interesting. It does show Solomon's basic character. He had a very interesting sort of mindset. In Gibeon, the Eternal appeared to Solomon in a dream by night and said, ask what I shall give you. Now, there is one of the most interesting questions that God could ever ask any of us. What do you want? And Solomon said, you have showed unto your servant David, my father, great mercy. According as he walked before you in truth, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart with you. And you kept for him this great kindness, that you have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. Now, O Eternal my God, you have made thy servant king instead of David my father, and I am but a little child. I know not how to go out or come in. You see, there was a humility here. He was probably a little bit, if you read the story of the coronation, and that there was a lot of political things going on with various people, and suddenly, you know, he found himself on the throne. And you could almost see a similar thing with King Charles. You know, suddenly he was actually king, and his whole demeanor changed. The responsibility, you know, hits him between the eyes. And it says in verse 10, and the speech pleased the Eternal that Solomon had asked this thing. And God said to him, because you have asked this thing and has not asked for long life for yourself, neither have you asked for riches for yourself, neither have you asked the life of your enemies, but you have asked for yourself understanding to discern judgment. Which is very interesting, because that's what a king does. That's what we're going to be doing. Discerning between those who obey God and those who don't. Verse 12. Behold, I have done according to your words. Lo, I have given you a wise and understanding heart, so that there is none like you before you, neither after you shall anyone arise like unto you. He is, according to what God says, the wisest man who ever lived. Verse 13. And I have also given to you that which you didn't ask for, both riches and honor. Note this, it's very interesting. So that there shall not be anyone among the kings like you unto thee all your days. Nobody will even get near you in riches and honor. And if you will walk in my ways and keep my statutes and my commandments as your father David did walk, then I will lengthen your days. I mean, this is a real cover-all promise, isn't it? It just covers everything that anybody could ever want. Now, if you turn to Ecclesiastes 1, you'll see Solomon's attitude here, at the beginning anyway. Ecclesiastes 1 and verse 16. This is obviously Solomon speaking. I communed with mine own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart has great experience of wisdom and knowledge. Mr. Armstrong writes about this, I think it's in the Seven Laws of Success this comes from. Mr. Armstrong wrote, perhaps the prize example of all history is that of an ancient king who strove hard, accomplished much, gained fabulous wealth. He experimented with every pleasure to see whether it brought happiness. This was his life's goal. What could he get out of it? And he tried everything. He says, continuing to describe his experiment, this man wrote, I searched with my mind how to cheer my body with wine. My mind's still guiding me with wisdom. Well, yeah, okay. Depends how much wine, I suppose, you drink. But you'd have thought after a while the wisdom would get washed away a little bit. He said, and how to lay hold of folly till I might see what was good. He tried laughter. He probably had jesters in and what's the latest joke type thing, you know. He was just striving to see what he could do that satiated his desires. This ancient king was young enough to try to really enjoy life. He could afford it too. He was one of the wealthiest men who ever lived, and the resources of a nation at his command. If there was not enough money for a project he dreamed up, he simply raised taxes. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? So he continued writing of his experiment and searching for happiness and success. I went for great works, stupendous national works and projects. I built mansions, planted vineyards. You know, this is not something you do in a week, as you'll see in a minute. Building mansions back then, the way they built buildings, it was years of work. You know, you don't plant a vineyard in 10 minutes, and it takes 4 to 5 years before you start producing grapes. I laid out gardens and parks for myself. Notice that, for myself. In which I planted all manner of fruit trees, making pools to water the trees in my plantations. I bought slaves, both men and women, and had slaves born within my house. Solomon spent 7 years building the temple. He's making note of that. It's 1 Kings 6:38. 7 years building the temple. And if you want to make a note in 1 Kings 7, verses 1 to 12, it took 13 years to build his own house. Right? Now, if you think of the temple and everything that went into it, I mean, it was quality from ground level up. We were talking about this the other night. You know, acacia wood is a very beautiful wood, and when you work with it, it's permanent. It doesn't rot. Nothing eats it. It's a fabulous wood. It's a beautiful wood. And God made a lot of the artifacts for the temple out of this acacia wood. Then he covered them in gold. Today we'd use box pine. If we're going to put gold on top, we wouldn't waste it. We wouldn't waste a good old acacia wood on it. There was quality right through that building. Every single thing. There's one comment, I think it's by Josephus, that they cover the walls in gold. After the walls have been covered with cedar, which is also beautiful in its own right, they covered the walls with gold. And when they put the gold plates together, they were made so accurately you could not see the join. This building, this temple, was completely incredible. Some of the works that went on, we couldn't. I don't think we could do it today. Those two columns out the front, I don't think we can cast them today. They're 40 foot high, 8 inches thick. Some sort of a bronzy type material that looked like gold, in actual fact, and they were cast down in the Jordan Valley and then hauled 2,000 odd feet up to Jerusalem. And they didn't have any of those great trucks that we've got today with, you know, 200 wheels on them. It was all done the hard way. Took 7 years. What was his house like? It took almost double that time to build. I mean, this is a creator. I mean, he really goes for it in a big way. He said, I had large herds and flocks, larger than any before me. I amassed silver and gold, right royal treasures. I procured singers, both men and women. I know I gave a sermonette in this one done in South Africa. People have been getting at the youth in the church because the loud music and all the rest of it. So I just pointed out that Solomon had I think it was a choir of something like 2,000. I think 1,000 of them were singers, and the other lot were playing various instruments. And it says the sound went out through all the land. You see, so I say it's not what you're listening. It's what you're listening to is the problem. The volume doesn't matter. And many a mistress. Yes, man's delight. Richer and richer I grew, more than any before me in my country. He was absolutely loaded. It says that gold was as common as muck, basically. They were just up to their neck in wealth. And peace. You know, when you get a nation that's at 40 years of peace, you can do a lot. You can do an awful lot. I mean, we here in this room have been greatly blessed. I don't know if we really realize it. And I was born January 44. The war was still going on, but for another 18 months. But since then, I've never known war. I've never sat in my house and wondering was something going to drop something on it and flatten me during the night. Never. Never had that fear. I've gone into war zones to take photographs. That's just plain stupid, but never mind. But, you know, I've never known. Neither of you. None of you. None of you. Nothing I coveted did I refuse myself. I denied my heart no enjoyment, for my heart did feel pleasure in all this, so much I did get from all my efforts. But, and here's the crunch, but, he concluded, when I turned to look at all I had achieved and all my efforts and trouble, then it was all vain and futile. It was all vanity and a striving after wind. And, you know, don't you think that's a horrendous shame? Here's a man who built fabulous buildings, planted, you know, vineyards, parks. Jerusalem must have been the most beautiful place, you know, to live in. And he'd done all this. And wind. The Jewish people describe it as on a cold morning you go out and you breathe out and you get the steam coming out, and it only goes about 2-3 feet and then it just dissipates and it's gone. That's what that vanity means. It's just nothing. Absolutely nothing. Utterly vain, utterly vain. Everything is vanity, wrote this king after all his life of experimenting. It led to was striving. Yes, always striving for what? After wind. After wind. Now, we're good at that where we live. We live on the side of a hill. We get all the wind. Even when there isn't any around, it's blowing up in our garden. After wind, he concluded. Yeah, nothingness. All that, a lifetime of hard work, vigorous application, material accomplishment brought him, he concluded, amounted to no more than a handful of wind. When he sat back and... Yeah. This king was called the wisest man who has ever lived. He was King Solomon of ancient Israel, but in all his costly experimenting, he never found the true values, the meaning of life, and lasting success. Simply because, with all his wisdom, this man sought pleasure, happiness, and success in one of the greatest tragedies of our modern world. In his own way, in materialism. In materialism, if you look at this world, that is the one big killer. Everybody, particularly in the West, you know, it's materialism. It's the things you own. King Solomon, like nearly all this world's successful men, applied diligently the first six rules of success. But without the seventh, he started out in the wrong direction. And the more he strived, the further he went in the direction away from the truth of lasting success. Because, you know, once you've built the temple of God, which was a smallish building, but was so stunning that one seen, never forgotten. And then he builds his own palace, which takes twice as long. And then he's got his pools, his gardens, his vineyards. The place must have been absolutely amazing to live in. But the more he got, what do you do next? You know? It's like the Star Wars movies. You know, you start off with something, then you've got to up the ante a little bit in the next one. Jaws, I think, was the more perfect, better example. Then the next one, the shark was a little bit bigger and a bit more sort of ominous. And then the next one was, and so it goes on. You've got to keep on adding the tempo and building up. But he was at the pinnacle. Then what do you do? What do you do? You've done all this. You can sit out on the veranda with a glass of wine, or a golden goblet of wine in his case, and look over all he surveyed. And he says, this is wind. I can't do any more. He might have tried all the physical things that this physical life had to offer, but it seems he never really tried God's way. Think about it. That's what we've got to teach in the millennium. Materialism is out, as we'll see as we go through some of the things. I wanted to concentrate on the difference that we're going into. We're going into a totally different world in every aspect, apart from the fact we're starting off with a blank canvas, because it'll all be blown up and leveled off and shaken and stirred. We're going back to tohu and bohu, basically, and we get to start again. All right, there are going to be some survivors, but not an awful lot. Few men left, it says. And if you think about it, this is how God works. We start off with Genesis 1. We have 6,000 years, then it's the curtain comes down, and a new age comes, and we have 1,000 years of God's rule. At the end of that, the curtain comes down again, and there's a new heaven and a new earth. And then what? Well, we'll have a look at that towards the end of the sermon. But this is the way we have. It's all like in sections. It's all in sections. We are privileged to live on the cusp of the greatest change, I think, ever so far. we're getting rid of Satan's way, and we're going to start going God's way. Turn to 1 Kings 11. This is where the problems for Solomon started. And it started because he disobeyed God's law. First off, he should not have taken an Egyptian woman. I'm sure there were plenty of pretty ladies in the land of Israel. But you see, Pharaoh's daughter meant he had an alliance with Egypt, who was a powerful nation at the time. And he formed alliances with all the nations around by marrying into their family, basically. And, well, 1 Kings 11, have a look at it. But King Solomon loved many strange women together with the daughter of Pharaoh. So he had the daughter of Pharaoh, who does come up several times in the scriptures as always being with him. Women of the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the Zionites, the Hittites, of the nations concerning which the Lord said unto the children of Israel, you shall not go into them, neither shall they come into you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. It says, Solomon clave unto these in love. Verse 3. And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wife turned away his heart. 700. Where did he put them all? Well, they probably all had palaces. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. Yeah, and in verse 4, for it came to pass when Solomon was old, and I think some got worn out, I'd imagine, that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect before the Eternal his God, as was the heart of David his father. You see, getting knocked off track, little bit at a time, and let's face it, once you've sacrificed to one of their gods, then, you know, what's wrong with the others? And Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Zidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. And Solomon did evil in the sight of the Eternal, and went not fully after the Eternal, as did David his father. Then did Solomon, it gets worse, verse 7, then did Solomon build on high places for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, in the hill that is before Jerusalem. Right in front of Jerusalem, right in front of everything he had built. He builds an altar to a pagan god. And for Molech, oh, that's a real good one, isn't it? They used to sacrifice their little babies on a cast iron thing. Really nice people. Great religion, too. I mean, wow. The abomination of the children of Ammon. That's how God looks at it. Sacrificing a little baby? Mind you, we don't do that today, do we? It's now going to become law, almost certainly in California, that until the child is 2, he isn't safe, according to the law. Because until they're 2, as far as they're concerned, there's nothing much going on in here, in the head. I beg to differ, because I've seen it in babies months old, the discernment and what they want, and they know how to get what they want, and yeah, especially once they can smile. Little girls soon learn to flutter their eyebrows, and granddad bows and begs to every turn. Don't you, Chris? Yeah, that's a tough one, that. Likewise he did for all his strange wives, and burnt incense and sacrificed unto their gods. This was a busy cookie. He had 700 wives, and they were all different religions. So, you know, it was around, who's on the books for today, you know? But of course, this didn't please God, did it? Verse 9 of 1 Kings 11. And the Eternal was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned from the Eternal God of Israel, which had appeared unto him twice. And he commanded him concerning this thing that he should not go after other gods, but he kept not that which the Lord had commanded. This is a face-to-face, eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation. This is what you will do, this is what you will not do. Based on, and he could look at how God had blessed him. In every way he blessed him. Whereas the Eternal said unto Solomon, for as much as you have done of thee, and you have not kept my covenant or my statutes which I have commanded you, I will surely rend the kingdom from you and will give it to your servant. That's tough, isn't it? He says, notwithstanding, in your days I will not do it for David your father's sake, but I will rend it out of the hand of your son. You see, in all this, God is true and faithful to his promises. And he honored the promise that he'd made to David, even in spite of all this provocation. I mean, how do you think God, if you were God and you're looking down on the sky, he's got 700 wives and they're all sacrificing to their own gods. And you specifically said to him, you know, we don't go this way. It says, albeit I will not rend away the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to the son for David, my servant's sake, and for Jerusalem's sake, which I have chosen. What we see here is the great split between the 10 tribes of Israel and basically Judah, with some of Levi, I believe, and Benjamin. And that's what we have today. And in the millennium, I think it's in Jeremiah, it talks about the stick of Israel and the stick of Judah, and you tie them together so that their back is being one people. One of the things that will happen right at the beginning of the millennium, the Jews will suddenly find out that the other 10 tribes are alive and well. Thank you. It's not just you guys. But they've been true and faithful, and at least most of them, some of them, have kept the Sabbath. Ecclesiastes 2. If you think of this, think of it as materialism. Think of it as the world we live in. Ecclesiastes 2 verse 18. Yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. All these men, the Gateses and the Bezoses and Musks, what's going to happen when they die? Somebody else will get that money. They can't take it with them. Not a penny of it. Oh, they can have a great funeral and a big mausoleum with flashing lights and, you know, all sorts of useless tech things stuck on it, probably. But that's it. They've gone. They're dead. Dead until the resurrection. He said, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. And he's looking at all the beauty that he's created. Somebody else is just going to take this. He says, and who knows whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? Yet shall I have rule over all my labor wherein I have labored, and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun? Of course I'm not. I'm gone when I die. This is also vanity, striving after wind. Mr. Armstrong said, with all his success, this man sought pleasure, happiness, and success his own way in materialism. So let's have a look at the world we live in today. Most people in the car industry will tell you cars are made to last 10 years. Yeah, that's it. Now, we've been very fortunate. I was still chugging along at 17 years old, but that's quite exceptional. Most of them, especially the more modern ones now, they start showing signs and creaking much earlier. Many people in the UK and in the States, they buy a new car when in England anyway, it needs an MOT after, I think, 3 years. So they don't want anything to do with an MOT. So it's the Ministry of Transport test. So they get rid of it just before then. And they get another one. British number plates show how old a car is. To some people, having the latest number plate is absolutely vital. If you haven't got an 017, oh dear me. To show their wealth. Or how deep in debt they are. This is more likely. Electrical appliances, washing machines, dishwashers, tumble dryers. What do they do? You buy one, they say, would you like a maintenance contract? 3 years. Because they know it'll last 3 years. Don't go the 4 years. How about the computer? A lot of the computers you buy in the shops are already outdated. Yeah. You know, I've got an i4. I've got an i5. I've got an i7. Yeah, but mine's got more hertzes than yours got. And this is how it goes on. Mine's quicker. I can do 20 trillion calculations in 5 seconds. Well, that's slow. And this is how it goes on and on and on. You can never, ever, ever get to the stage where you've got it. Because even if you've got a supercomputer, of which there's only a handful on the face of the earth, somebody's out there building a bigger one and a quicker one. And if your appliance breaks, you go to the shop, you say, my dishwasher's on the blink. Oh dear, what's it doing? Oh, it's making a funny grinding noise, and it's, oh, that'll be the motor and the drum and the bearing and the... Too expensive to repair, you better buy a new one. Of course it's too expensive to repair. You try and buy the spare parts. Yeah? It's incredible. You buy two, three little spare parts for a dishwasher and you've spent half as much as you would spend buying a brand new one. So you buy a brand new one. Materialism. This is what psychologists have come up with. But it's actually very interesting. It's a system that eats us from the inside out. And look at what it did to King Solomon. He had it all. He'd done it all. He's been there. He had so many t-shirt factories that he couldn't keep them all going. He had the lot. And what was he? Oh, it's all vanity. Unbelievable. This is what the psychologist says. Buying more stuff is associated with depression, anxiety, and broken relationships. It is socially destructive and self-destructive. An impressive body of psychological research seems to support these feelings. It suggests that materialism, a trait that can affect both rich and poor, and which the researchers define as, quote, a value system that is preoccupied with possessions and the social image they project. I've got a Gucci handbag. Yeah? I can only put the same amount of stuff in it as I can the cheap one from Tesco's. It's just a handbag, and it's got a zip on it and a strap on my shoulder. But it's a Gucci. And for that you pay £700. But the handbag itself's probably only worth 20. But it's this thing of materialism. You look at these new cars, these supercars, a Bugatti. It's a Chiron's the latest one, isn't it? Is that Chiron? Yeah, it's only $4 million. You can't drive this stupid thing. In first gear, it's broken all the speed limits anywhere in the world. Where can you go? Oh, you might be lucky and have a track nearby. But then you kill yourself because it's too quick. But it's just, but I've got a Chiron. Yeah. Well, Solomon was just the same. I've got 20,000 cattle out there on the field and I've got 40,000 sheep over here. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. The man from Texas says, yeah, I got the same as all in the deep freeze. He said, it's socially destructive and self-destructive. It smashes the happiness and peace of mind of those who succumb to it. It's associated with anxiety, depression, and broken relationships. This is a dreadful mistake we are making. Allowing ourselves to believe that having more money and more stuff enhances our well-being, a belief possessed by almost every member of almost every government in the world today. Worldly ambition, material aspiration, perpetual growth, these are the formula for mass unhappiness. And in the news just a while back, there was a company that just went boing down on the stock exchange. Oh, big massive drop. Chief executive fired. Why? Last year, they made £600 million profit. This year, they only made £595 million profit. In the way the world's trading at the moment, they should have given the guy a gold medal. But no growth. Year out, next man in. Growth is growth is growth is growth. That's what it's all about. All the shenanigans going on with our government at the moment. They're trying to stimulate growth. Got to have growth. It's a more materialism. Yes. You see, Solomon, at the end of Ecclesiastes, sums it all up. He says, you know, what does it all boil down to? He says, fear God and keep the commandments. This is the whole man. That's the only thing that's going to survive. That's what we're going to teach. The people in the millennium are going to have it with... We'll go through some of the stuff just now, but the world they inherit is going to be fabulous. Yeah, no weeds, no bugs eating all your crops. You know, people trying to sow stuff, overtaking the people trying to reap the previous crop. Yeah, the most well-fed chickens in the world, because you've got to clear the store out to get the new stuff in, because you've eaten all the, you know, you need to get rid of the old stuff. But they got to learn that all this is just a blessing, it's part of your way of life, but it means nothing. It's a grasping after wind. You're doing it because there's a purpose to the millennium. The millennium is designed to get the whole world ready for that resurrection at the end of it. When Christ turned to the thief on the cross and said, "Verily, verily, I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise." And it talks about the whole world becoming as the Garden of Eden. But people will be told, you get to a certain stage, and you either, whether they die or they're changed or whatever the situation is, we don't know. But they become, they join the God family. What else do you want? Do you want wisdom? Do you want knowledge? Do you want understanding? Do you want a body that works completely? You get all that in one smack, being immortal. Yeah. Well, let's look at a few aspects of this wonderful world that we live in. Isaiah 2 verse 1. We had a good split sermon on this, but I just want to add I already had this done, so I'm adding my two bobs worth, as they say. Isaiah 2 verse 4. And he shall judge among the nations, and shall rebuke many people. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. I never put this in my notes, but somebody mentioned it. I think it might be Paul. See, if you thought the word, if you thought the language you're going to teach the children, there'll be certain words that they won't even need. They won't need police. They won't need army. They won't need bombs. They won't need words to signify guns. You know, the list just goes on and on and on, because they're not going to exist. They simply aren't going to exist. Oh, house of Jacob, come and let us walk in the light of the eternal. That's what it says in Isaiah. It's repeated a bit later on, we'll see. But you know, if you look at the economy of America, some of these figures are staggering. America is spending, their budget this year is $782 billion for defense. Defense against what? Who'd be daft enough to attack America? No, it's for war. Call it what it is. To put that in perspective, there are 190 nations on the face of this earth, and only 18 of them have a gross domestic product larger than the American defense budget. 18 nations. And they're mostly Western nations, obviously. The rest don't even come near. That's how crazy this situation is. In England or Britain, we have around about 130,000 directly employed in the whole defense industry. In America, the Boeing company, just one company, employs 170,000 people. And then you get Raytheon and on, producing implements of war. Active personnel in the armed forces, for defense, of course, 1,358,500. That's huge. Well, with another 800,000 in reserve. If you think of the American economy, there's all these people all involved in the military and making all the goodies for the military. They're all pretty well paid. So they've got to buy cars, they've got to buy TVs and dishwashers and washing machines and all the other stuff that people buy and live on, restaurants, luxury goods even, holidays. What happens if that defense industry suddenly stopped? You know, the American economy would simply collapse because these people wouldn't be able to buy anything. It's amazing that the defense industry is the basis, and that's what Eisenhower tried to warn. President Eisenhower tried to warn people. He says, this industrial conglomerate, he says, you're going to have to control it because they will be in there, and they do. They bribe this one and bribe that one. Talk about insider trading. You know, as a member of Congress or whatever, that there's a big order going to be placed with Raytheon for so many hundreds of jet planes, and it's going to be, you know, billions and billions and billions. That happens, their stock on the market goes way up in a big jump. So you go to your mate and you say, a few more bucks, buy up Raytheon shares, many as you can afford. Sink every penny you got into it. And he says, watch the price. When the price gets to this level, sell. It's called insider trading. And it's not technically illegal in the American government. But there's no corruption, of course. We read in Isaiah about turning spears into pruning hooks. The prophet Micah makes the same quote. Micah 4 verse 3. Micah 4 verse 3. And he shall judge among many people and rebuke strong nations afar off, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. But, verse 4 is added, but they shall sit every man under his vine and his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Eternal of Hosts has spoken it. Think about that one. No more war. No more threat of war. But it also points out that people are going to be responsible for growing their own food and veggies and things. You know, what are we having for dinner? Oh, we're going to have some soup. Right, so you go out in the garden, you yank a few carrots up, and you yank a few leeks up, and whatever else you stick in your soup. Fresh. You get a bowl of salad on the table and you notice at the bottom of the lettuce, where it's been cut from the root, has got white juice coming out of it. Today you buy a lettuce from the supermarket, you take it out of the bag and the whole bottom's black. Because it's been stuck in the bag for a month probably, with all the oxygen taken out so it doesn't degrade. And you chop all that off and there you've got a lovely lettuce. It's just pure lump of cellulose. There's no goodness left in it. Oh, but it's crunchy. It looks nice. Foodless food. We can go on for hours on that subject. We understand from end time events that every living thing in the sea dies. You know, when Satan does his little thing, I think it's a third of the ships in the sea come to grief and so on. But when Christ comes and he starts dishing out the seven last plagues, everything in the sea dies. Every living soul dies. Right, so there could be some recreating going on. Yeah? How about some nice salmon? Not the farm variety. Today, things we buy, even the fish, they've got plastic in them. They've eaten it. It's ingested into the very body. Even mum's breast milk nowadays has definitely got this plastic stuff in it. It's got everywhere. We have ruined everything, every blessing that God has given us. We have ruined. Much of the fish and animal meat we buy today is farmed. It's processed. And it's rubbish. You know, salmon's all right, but you really don't want to be eating too much of it, they tell you. Turn to Genesis 3. See, the problem's all here. It's all very obvious in the Bible what the problem is. And dare I say, it all goes back to them two trees. Shows the wrong way. And Genesis 3:17, and unto Adam he said, because you have hearkened unto the voice of your wife, and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it, cursed is the ground for your sake. In sorrow shall you eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of your face shall you eat bread, till you return to the ground. For out of that you were taken, and from dust you are, and from dust you will return. That's a curse. That's a curse. That curse will be removed. That curse will be removed. Growing food is obviously going to be an awful lot easier, as you'll see. It's hard work trying to grow crops in a land full of weeds and bugs. It's a big problem today. We have all the herbicides and pesticides and all the other sides that they spray on our food. And then we wonder why we get all the diseases that we get. And then on top of that, we try growing them in ground that is technically dead. It's just full of artificial fertilizer. What they're going to do this next year with 70% of the fertilizer not being produced is another good, interesting question. Restoration is badly needed. The land, literally, from the ground up. People will be taught. We need to teach people. The most important thing you've got on your land is your land. That's where your food grows in. You know, if you get land that is alive, it's full of bacteria, those bacteria aid the plant by allowing it to take up nutrients out of the soil. Minuscule quantities of even things like arsenic and molybdenum and all sorts of chemicals our bodies need, and they're not getting them because there's nothing there. All you've got is nitrate, which of course is originally made for bombs. They got to the end of the First World War with all these big factories making this stuff, and they found they could use it for fertilizers. So they just kept on making it. That's why the generation that we've just lost, the grannies and the Danutas and all that, these people lived up way into their 90s, and they were still pretty healthy. We used to tease granny, she had a little bit of a broken tooth in the front. The rest of them were all hers, at 98, 99 almost, yeah. Yeah. But look at the difference. Turn to Amos 9. Look at the difference. Complete and utter change. And this is what we keep getting all the way. This is the message, I think, from this feast that's come through so much, is that how different the millennium is actually going to be. We need to get it in our head. Even the knowledge we have, as it said, the knowledge we have is rubbish. Everything. Amos 9 verse 13, behold, the days come, says the Eternal, that the ploughman shall overtake the reaper, the treader of grapes him that sows seeds, and the mountain shall drop sweet wine, and all the hills shall melt. Why? Superabundance, top quality, because God's law will be being observed. That's why. Because we'll be there saying to people, this is what you do. This is how you handle it. This is what you put on the ground. And when you get that all done, you start producing crops and animals as well that are nutritions. They're pure nutrition. That's what we need. And sickness won't happen unless you break laws. And one of the biggest things is water, which we had a sermon on. Isaiah 41 verse 17. You see, God puts the importance on things that we don't tend to. You know, here we've got the world all chewed up, all ploughed up, ready for resorting. In verse 17 of Isaiah 41, when the poor and needy seek water, and there is none, and their tongue fails for thirst, I, the Eternal, will hear them. I, the Eternal God of Israel, will not forsake them. It's an absolute promise. I will open rivers in the high places and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. right? I will plant in the wilderness the cedar, the acacia tree, and the myrtle, and the oil tree. I will set in the desert the fir tree and the pine. Some translations there read oak, and the box or the cedar tree together, that they may see and know and consider and understand altogether that the hand of the Eternal has done this and the Holy One of Israel has created it. What's he doing? He's creating the basic foundational building blocks of the Garden of Eden all around the world. How many trees is it going to take to cover the Sahara Desert? I sure hope we ain't going to plant them, because it goes on forever. And all the other deserts of the world. And look at the stupidity of man, right? Our bodies are, I don't know what the exact percentage is, something ridiculous, like half our body basically is water of one form or another. A lot of our sicknesses are because we don't drink enough water. But today, the one thing we have trashed almost completely is our water supply. I remember Mr. McNair went to India, and he came back, and he found it very hard to explain even the sermon. He says, you go down to the Ganges, and you're standing on the bank, and in front of you, you've got a whole lot of women in the river, up to their waist, washing their clothes. You've got a holy man down there, scooping up the water and drinking it, right? Further down, you've got somebody else attending to his toilet facilities. Same river. And 20 yards from the bank, there's a body slowly floating down the river. I rest my case. That's the most precious thing that the nation has, is this water. Look at what happens when the Mount of Olives cleaves in two. You get this water that comes out. Pure water. Everywhere it goes, everything grows. Water, water, water. Where do you get decent water today? Well, frankly, it's almost impossible. It's even down in the Antarctica, some of the fresh water down there, it's got DDT in it. We haven't made DDT for years. It still hangs around. And you drink it. Oh, small quantities. But those small quantities can be the difference between life and death, literally. Yeah, dead bodies, bathing, drinking, cooking, toilets. Yeah, wonderful. The Chinese. This is why I'm very careful where we buy food from. Anything that's grown in China, I won't touch because it's well known that they use industrial waste to water their crops in some areas. Yeah, it's a byproduct of some of these industries, and it's heavily laden with all sorts of rubbish, and they use that. They use that to fertilize their crops. Ezekiel 34. You see, you're talking about a completely different world. Ezekiel 34, verse 25. And I will make with them a covenant of peace, and will cause the evil beasts to cease out of the land, and they shall dwell in safety in the wilderness and sleep in the woods. Oh, lovely. Would you want to try that today? So I will make of them the places around about my hill a blessing. I will cause the shower to come down in his season, and shall be showers of blessings. And the tree of the field shall yield her fruit, and the earth shall yield her increase. And they shall be safe in their land, and they shall know that I am the Eternal. And that's the message of the book of Ezekiel, basically. You find that expression used all the way through. Even Malachi, the tithing little bit. Turn to Malachi 3. Malachi 3 and verse 10. Bring you all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in my house. And prove me now herewith, said the Eternal of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour out blessings, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. Yes. And the ploughman's getting chased by the guy wanting to plant the next load of seeds. Then, yeah, that's a blessing. Yes, that's a blessing. I will rebuke the devourer for your sakes, and he shall not destroy the fruit of your ground. all nations shall call you blessed. Let's turn back to two sections of scripture that we use a lot these days. Deuteronomy 28 and first, and then Leviticus 26. We tend to concentrate today on the cursings, because that's what we're living in. But look at the blessings. That's what we're going to be overseeing. That's what people in the millennium are going to enjoy. Deuteronomy 28, verse 2. And all these blessings shall come on you and overtake you if you only hearken to the voice of the Eternal your God. Blessed will you be in the city, and blessed will you be in the field. Well, today the city's a war zone, the field's flooded, or it's dead with drought. Blessed shall be the fruit of your body, and the fruit of the ground, and the fruit of the cattle, and the increase of your kin, and the flocks and sheep. Just think of that. Blessed shall be the basket in your store. Blessed shall be you be when you come in, and blessed you'll be when you go out. How much more blessed do you want? That's what God says. But when I got to Leviticus, something really, you've read this hundreds of times, but you read over it. Leviticus 26, verse 4. Then I will give you rain in due season, and the land shall yield her increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. And your threshing shall reach unto the vintage, and the vintage shall reach unto the sowing time, and you shall eat your bread to full and dwell in your land safely. And I will give peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid. And I will get rid of evil beasts out of the land. Now this shall the sword go through your land. And verse 10, and you shall eat the old store and bring forth the old because of the new. Yeah, there's some grain left in there. We've got to get rid of it, guys. The new stuff's been harvested now. So, good old chickens, they're going to really live well. They're going to really live well. And these blessings, it continues on, and it shows it's millennial. I've never quite seen it in this sense before. Read on, verse 11. And I will set my tabernacle among you. My soul will not abhor you. And I let verse 12 sink in. Because I say, I had read over this and read over this and never got it, frankly. And I will walk among you. God said, I will walk among you. I'll be there. You'll see me. And I will be your God and you will be my people. That's in the millennium. Think about it. How different do you want? How different do you want? When you can see God, literally. When you have a problem and you can pray, and suddenly a member of the God family appears and says, right, this is what you got to do. Probably even muscles in and helps out a little bit to get it going or whatever it is. Yeah. I will walk among you. No messing around with the translation. You can't claim anything else. That's what it says. Now that's a real change. That's a mega change. And of course, we've got to read Isaiah 20, haven't we? I know we read this every feast, because this is our job description. This is our job description. Isaiah 20, verse 19. Oh, people of Zion who live in Jerusalem, you will weep no more. He will be gracious if you ask for help. He will surely respond to the sound of your cries. This is the New Living Translation. Though the Lord gave you adversity for food and suffering for drink, he will still be with you to teach you. You will see your teacher with your own eyes. Your own ears will hear him right behind you when a voice will say, this is the way, walk ye in it. You know, after the 1,000-year millennium, we have the 100 years white throne judgment. That's going to be a lot of fun, isn't it? If you're to trace your family right the way back. Could be embarrassing. But that'll be dealt with on the last great day, which, of course, yes, we're almost there, aren't we? This is the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles. Abraham understood about the White Throne Judgment. But you turn to Hebrews 10, 11. Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11 and verse 10. For Abraham looked for a city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. He could see this. That's where his vision was. That's why he did what he did. That's why he lived God's way, because he had this vision of not the millennium and not the White Throne Judgment period, but beyond. He was focused on beyond. 2 Peter 3. A man I really would have loved to be able to sit down and talk to. Peter. The Apostle Peter. 2 Peter 3 verse 13. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for a new heavens and a new earth wherein dwells righteousness. We're looking for a new world where there's only righteousness, where every living thing, every immortal being is living according to God's law. And if you turn back again to a scripture we always seem to read at this time of the year, because it's very interesting when you think about it, and the more you think about it, the more interesting it gets. Isaiah 65 verse 17. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered nor come into mind. So this whole 7,000 year plan, probably going back, I mean, how far does it go back? Satan's rebellion, is that all gone? Looks like it. Everything that's existed up until this time is wiped out, because what's coming up is so incredibly amazing, and that's where our focus is going to be. We're not looking back anymore. We're looking forward the whole time. Turn to Isaiah 8. Some of the, we don't tend to look at this perhaps in this light, but you know, you and I, we have a kind of like an awesome responsibility here. Isaiah 8 verse 16. Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples. And I will wait upon the Eternal that hides his face from the house of Jacob, which of course he's doing right now. And I will look for him. Behold, I and the children whom the Lord has given me are for signs and wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts, which dwells in Mount Zion. Drop down to verse 20. To the law and to the testimony, if they speak not according to this world, it is because there is no light in them. And what's this testimony? Well, turn to Revelation 19 and we'll find out. Revelation 19 verse 10, you recall, we have the Apostle John going through the most amazing time that any human being has ever gone through. Vision after vision after vision. And here he's now in front of this angel, and he fell at his feet to worship him. And he said unto me, don't do this. I am just a fellow servant and of thy brethren that have the testimony of Jesus. Worship God. For the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. It's the spirit of forth-telling, but it's also the spirit of teaching. That's what we're doing now. This is part of the testimony. It's what God said. That's why our spiritual heritage is so critical. Because if you don't believe that spiritual heritage, they've got a problem. That's a real problem. Just make a note of, Mark chapter 4. Mark chapter 4. Our future is prophesied. God has entrusted us with the greatest secret of all time. We are the guardians of the mystery of God. We are the only people who understand what all this is about. This is what Solomon was missing. He had all the physical things he'd done, been there, done that, and yeah. He done it all, and a few things we probably don't even know about. And yet, he didn't know this. And it doesn't matter if you're sitting here and you haven't got two pennies to rub together in your pocket. If you know this, you're way better off than Solomon ever was. Mark 4, verse 11. And he said to them, unto you it is given to know the mystery of the kingdom of God. But unto them that are without, all these things are done in parables, so that they won't understand. Let you go back a little bit to something we read just a few minutes ago. So yeah, Hebrews 2. Just to show you how Christ looks on us. Hebrews 2 verse 10. For it became him for whom are all things and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons into glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through suffering. For both he that sanctifies and they who are sanctified are all of one, for which cause he is not ashamed to call them brethren. Think about that one. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and by him were all things created. That's the one. He is calling us brothers. He is calling us family. Now, not yet born, but, you know, if the lady's carrying a baby around, it's on the way, isn't it? It's got to be born. Saying, I will declare my name unto my brethren in the midst of the church, I will sing praise to you. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, behold, I and the children which God has given me. But you've got to go back to Isaiah to get the last bit of that verse. We are for signs and wonders in Israel. We are for signs and wonders in Israel. When? When we walk among the people in the millennium. How much more of a sign than a wonder do you want? Think about it. That's you and me. I will walk among you. That will be a monster sign and a wonder. Let's just go back quickly now in closing to the holy city. Revelation 21. Revelation 21 and verse 1. See, this is another one of these major sea changes, as they say, that's on the horizon. It's only 1,000 years away. That's a day, basically, in God time. Revelation 21 verse 1. I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there were no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven say, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. God the Father there. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there will be no more death, neither sorrow, nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away, and won't even come to mind, basically. And he said, he that sat on the throne said, behold, I make all things new, a completely new start. And he said to me, you write, for these words are true and faithful. The Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 13:12 wrote, for now we see through a glass darkly. Now I know in part, he said. And I saw one quote, and it says, eternity alone can unfold the whole scheme of the gospel. The gospel of Jesus Christ isn't just now. It's not just the millennium. It's ongoing. Think about that. It's ongoing. It's the good news of the kingdom of God. And, you know, what happens in the kingdom of God? Well, it goes on and on and on. Mr. Armstrong, as we heard in the sermonette, when he got to the end of the mystery of the ages, he just said, what happens now? Well, we come to the beginning. It's when it all changes again. Now, perhaps we understand Isaiah 9, verse 7. Let's close with that one, I think. Isaiah 9, verse 7. When you get this concept that it's growth all the way through the millennium, we will undoubtedly be learning all through the millennium. The white throne judgment period will be another period of growth. And then at the end of that, it's a complete cleanup, a new world, a new heaven, a new earth. God the Father actually here on the earth, or the new earth. Yes. Isaiah 9 verse 7 tells us, if we just have the brain, the mind to understand, of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end. Why? Because it goes on. I put it to you, and this is pure speculation, based on what I've read, right? But you have 6,000 years of man, ba-dum, complete change. You have 1,000 years of the millennium and the white throne judgment period. Boom, complete change. New heaven and new earth. Then what? Is that it? No. God says, you rejoice. He said, you rejoice with me in my creation. He's a creator. He goes on creating. Yes. Of the increase of his government and peace, there should be no end upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it, to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth, even forever. Ever. It just goes on. It's a continual growth. We will be involved in this forever. And we'll be immortal and we'll be able to enjoy it. Sense of accomplishment will be tremendous. And it wasn't the last scripture, because we've got to turn to Isaiah 51 to finish off. Here we just get a little hint as to what it could be. Isaiah 51 verse 16. I have put my words in your mouth. I have covered you in the shadow of my hand, that I may plant the heavens. The new telescope they got up there just now just took another photograph. And guess what? The further you go out, there's still more galaxies. It just goes on and on and on. Not a few more, billions more. And each one has got billions of stars in it. You can't get this in your mind. You hear of galaxies colliding. Does that mean they all smash into each other? No. The distances between all the different stars is so great, they just literally pass through. Most of the time, I mean, obviously it might be a collision now and again, but not really. These galaxies are massive, beyond our imagination. That I may plant the heavens, lay the foundations of the earth, and say to Zion, you are my people. How will this happen? Oh. This is tomorrow's news, people. This is going to be in the news, all of it. Not history, like we looked back to yesterday to see what somebody said in wherever. This is real news. This is what's coming. And how do we know it's right? Well, read the last line of Isaiah 9, verse 7. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this.